Hello, and welcome to the Inside of Views podcast for February the 28th, 20, 2022. This is a midweek bonus episode and the third of our charging infrastructure series. On today's show, we are pleased to be joined by Jonathan Levy, who is the Chief Commercial Officer at EVgo. EVgo bills itself as the nation's largest public network of DC fast chargers, powered by 100% renewable energy. I'm Dominic Yoni, Inside EV's forum moderator and Inside EV's editor, and I'm here today with Tom Malogny, Inside EV's editor and host of the YouTube channel State of Charge. So before we get going, I'd like to ask that you please subscribe to the show. If you're watching us on YouTube, please hit that thumbs up button and ring that bell icon for notifications so you don't miss any of our surprise bonus episodes. If you're watching us on Twitch, you can also ring that bell icon for notifications. All right, so with that out of the way, welcome everybody. Good morning. So this is the third episode in our series of midweek bonus podcasts centered on charging infrastructure, where we talk to people from different charging networks and utilities and possibly others to get a sense of where we're at now and where we want to be in the future and what are the challenges and opportunities involved. So Jonathan, as I mentioned, you are the Chief Commercial Officer at EVgo. I look forward to hearing more about the company in a moment, but first, can you start off with a bit about the path that led you to your current position? I understand that you actually studied political science in a university and were an advisor at some of the highest levels of government recently. And then maybe tell us about what the Chief Commercial Officer at EVgo kind of does on a daily basis.
Sure, happy to do so. And Dom and Tom, thank you so much for having me. It's a privilege to talk directly to your audience. And obviously, the most important equation when we're talking about electrifying transportation is the drivers themselves. So very happy to be here and looking forward to the conversation. I think it is fair to say that I have a somewhat unusual path to the role that I had. I did study political science at Emory University, but went out to DC knowing that I was a congressional nerd. And it took a little while to become an EV nerd. So I spent some time on the Hill working for then Congressman Rahm Emanuel, and then was in the Obama administration for 6 years, mostly at the Department of Energy with a brief stint at the White House. Finished up my public service as the Deputy Chief of Staff to Secretary of Energy, Ernie Moniz. And then when I was looking to switch and figure out what was next, I started having some conversations about how could I take the experience I had and shift from the policy tools to the actual deployment of clean energy technologies, as I wanted to continue contributing to fight climate change as being mission-oriented has always been a part of who I am. And so I joined an investment firm called Vision Ridge Partners based in Boulder. And Vision Ridge bought the controlling stake of EVgo from NRG in 2016. And I had been on that diligence team with the investment that Vision Ridge led. And eventually when there was a shift and we brought on Kathy Zoya as CEO, Kathy called me up and said, hey, you know, we've worked together before. Help me grow this thing. It's going to be a ton of fun. And this is how you can really make a difference directly in transportation electrification. And she's a very convincing CEO. And so she convinced me to move to LA. And I did that. And I've been with EVgo ever since. As far as the second part of your question, as Chief Commercial Officer, I'm responsible for growing the top line of the company. It's very important, as you noted, that we are 100% renewable powered, but we're committed to being sustainable both environmentally and financially. So underneath my aegis includes all of our partnership work with automakers, utilities, fleets, core of those commercial agreements that we have on a B2B basis, as well as the marketing communications work, our policy work, the grants making, things like that. But really, all of us work together at EVgo to be able to scale and accelerate the deployment of EVs. Kathy often says to us, every single member of EVgo is a member of the marketing team. So I'm happy to be here, but there's a lot of other folks that wear EVgo clothes and go out there and make sure that whether it's them charging or they're driving by, that we figure out ways to help customers everywhere we can.
All right, cool. So tell us a little bit about EVgo itself now. Maybe start with what parts of the country that you're in, how many locations you have, and the different power levels that you offer, and maybe what your medium-term future growth plans look like.
Sure, happy to. So, you know, EVgo has the most locations of any public fast charging network in the U.S. We're well over 800 locations at this point across around 35 states. And we have focused on those fast chargers because we recognize that is the key way to get folks to really accelerate and have that one vehicle be an EV. I think that the evolution of this industry, as you and your audience well know, is at the beginning, the first, you know, i3 and Leaf buyers were very much single family home residence. It was their second vehicle. It was a commuter car. But now that we have 200 plus mile range vehicles that are at a more affordable price point for everybody, you can be like our CEO, an apartment dweller who doesn't have access to home charging and still make it work. And so that's been the focus. However, we do have more than 1,100 level two chargers in our public network. And over the past couple of years, we've really ramped up the work we've done on fleet. We started in the beginning working with Rideshare, with GM's Maven Gig program, but then moving with Lyft and Uber. And now I've been seeing much more in the delivery space and the logistics arenas where we've seen a lot more emphasis on everybody wanting to go electric. And so EVgo has been ramping up our ability to help serve all sorts of partners, whether it's the EV drivers themselves on a retail basis or the commercial fleet drivers as well.
Awesome, thank you. Tom, do you have a question?
Start off with bringing a comment from the audience on and expand on it a little bit. So the last comment, Tom, that Mario made, I have a soft spot for EVgo. When EA let me down with my e-Golf, EVgo was there and worked flawlessly. And that's one thing that I wanna point out. I have a soft spot for EVgo also because I'm one of the early adopters. And back, you know, in the early years, 2014, 2015, that was it. I mean, EVgo was DC fast charging. There were a couple of Blink stations here and there sprinkled around. They didn't work. But EVgo always worked. And that's my experience already that, you know, whenever I go to an EVgo station, I plug in, it works. Now, we're going to get into a little bit later the power level, because being an early adopter, I mean, I think one of the sayings are that, you know, you can tell the pioneers by the amount of arrows in their backs. One of the faults we can fault EVgo is a lot of their existing legacy chargers are 50 kilowatt, whereas the new stations coming out are higher power. But I still have I have a soft spot for EVgo because you guys were the first out there, and the equipment always works. So I want to thank you for that. But I also want to expand a little bit on power levels, because 50 kilowatt works in some instances, but not for long distance travel, really. With the size of the packs coming out now, you talked about recharging a Leaf or an i3 battery pack. That was great, you know, 8 years ago when the batteries were 20 to 30 kilowatt hour. But now we have 100 kilowatt hour plus battery packs. And charging at 50 kilowatt is going to mean more than an hour stop for 10 to 80% refill. Could you talk a little bit about your plans to install higher powered units? And are you going to continue to install 50 kilowatt units?
Yeah, so great series of questions. First of all, Mario, thank you. We agree. We think that the reliability is one of those most important things. When I came to EVgo, and when most of the folks that we've hired from outside of the EV industry come to EVgo, the first thing they learn is that, hey, reliability is still a competitive differentiator. And maybe it shouldn't be that way, but it still is. And that's why we have invested so much in preventative and corrective maintenance and very rigorous testing before we deploy things out into the field. In terms of power level, I think, you know, Tom, it's very clear that we were a first mover. We were a first learner for a long time. 50 kW was all there is. EVgo did install the very first 150 kW charger in the US and the first 350 kW charger in the US. But until this year, no cars could take the 350, right? And so it became this question for a really long time. Would we rather install more chargers or higher power chargers, fewer higher power chargers that everybody could use? Now that equation has flipped, right? You've seen what's happened this year in particular with Kia and Hyundai moving very quickly on 800 volt vehicles with the IONIQ 5 and the EV6. And that's a huge shift in that mid-tier price point. So hats off to those folks and a bunch of other automakers that are bringing 800 volt plus vehicles to the market. So for EVgo, we have shifted. We aren't installing new 50 kWs except in some limited circumstances where either a fleet wants it behind the fence or there's a reason that there's a particular application, because we do want to match the use case to the throughput, right? It doesn't necessarily make sense to put a level two charger someplace where you're only spending 30 minutes. And it doesn't necessarily make sense to put a 350 kW charger where you know you're spending 2 hours. But to the very core point of your question, Tom, you know, we have been doing a combination of upgrading some existing stations and focusing very much on installing 100 to 350 kW chargers out in the field. That's what we've been putting out. Our new standard configuration is rooted in those 350 kW power share units and 100 kW. One of the things that I think is a really important shift over the next couple of years, because most Americans do not speak kilowatt or kilowatt hour, is doing more education, right? We have a responsibility, as Chris Nelder at RMI always says, to teach the units, because most folks don't even look at their home electricity bill, let alone really delve in. Now, a lot of your listeners are more sophisticated and understand that kW is power, kWh is energy, and it really does matter where you are in the charging curve, and that the car ultimately controls the maximum rate of charge of the vehicle. We've had a couple of customers call us and complain that they're not drawing 350 kW on cars that can't draw 350 kW. Or we've had some folks that have cars that can draw 150 that call and complain because they're only getting 100, but the car's at 70%. And the car is what's governing that maximum rate of charge. So we have a collaborative effort that we need to do to say, look, the maximum speed of how you're going to charge depends on three things: the capability of the vehicle, the capability of the charger, and the state of charge of your vehicle. And that will be an ongoing learning effort for a long time. But in the meantime, this revolution is happening because more cars, more options, more capabilities are out there. And we have work and responsibility to continue to push the envelope on putting faster chargers out there.
I agree. And there's one thing to follow up. I think you should, in your education, point out that the temperature also plays an enormous role in the amount of power it will take. State of charge and temperature on the vehicle side is going to really dictate the power that the vehicle takes in.
Yeah, and related is preconditioning. I think one of the things that's been a big shift is, you know, I know, Tom, that you're a Tesla driver. And so it's one of those things where your Tesla knows when you put in the nav that you're going to a charging station to warm it up. And that means that it can take a higher rate of charge to begin with. Now, it may peak and taper pretty quickly, depending on what's happening at that particular station. But that's a big, big advantage as well, is that ability to precondition, since it is complicated. You know, one of the things that we often talk about at EVgo is that an L2 charger, which is extremely important for home use, it's extremely important for fleets and for workplace charging, it's not the same as a DC fast charger, right? An L2 has a couple hundred components, and DC fast chargers have more than 2,000 components. And an L2 installation is kind of hooking something up like a washer dryer, and a DC charging installation is a construction project. So there are different nuances, whether it's cost or time and complexity, that go into all of these things. And that's a work in progress as we continue to grow as an industry, because it is still fairly nascent.
So we had the CEO of Allego from Europe on here last week, and his vision of charging future included fewer modalities than what we see today, you know, on-street charging and neighborhood slower charging. He saw, you know, everything kind of going to, you know, super fast charging at locations like similar to gas station distribution right now. So what is the EVgo kind of vision of the future? Like, do you see like a role for on-street charging or at work charging and like high speed at locations, or do you think everything's going to go? Maybe that's where all the money is. I don't know. Super high speed charging.
Yeah, Dom, it's a great question. I think some of it depends on your vision of ACES, which is the former buzzword that we don't hear as often from the auto industry as we did a couple of years ago. But if we think about autonomous, connected, electrified, and shared, the more that you have vehicles that are autonomous, connected, electrified, and shared, the more that fast charging really matters. Because if the utilization of the vehicle is your most important phenomenon, then you can't take something out of service for hours to charge it. You need fast charging. When it comes to retail, I think the EVgo position is that we need it all. We need home charging. We need workplace charging. We need a lot of fast charging, particularly as the vehicles get bigger. Let's take a look at pickup trucks, right? The big excitement this year is the Rivians, the Ford F-150s Lightnings, the new announcement from Chevy about the electric Silverado. It opens up a whole new set of segments for American drivers to go electric. But those are bigger, heavier vehicles, including the electric Hummer, right? It takes more energy to go the same distance in a bigger, heavier vehicle, which means fast charging is also critically important for those use cases. I do have a slight bias against on-street charging, and I think it's for a couple of really key reasons. And we can get into this as much or as little as you want, but it's one of those things that cities really like it, because they start from the logic of it's something we can control. We control the curb. Let's go after it. But the reality is that the curb evolves. And if you're going to put hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars of infrastructure into street side charging in any way, you're not going to want a quick evolution. And if suddenly we need a bike lane, or we need another lane to drop off for Uber or other delivery, and you're talking about some amount of eminent domain, are we digging that up and moving it? Additionally, there are some safety issues. I don't know if you've seen this legendary picture that's gone around about an LAL2 where the cable for charging goes right across the bike lane so that if it was nighttime and you were charging, it'd be a decapitation risk. Now, they shut it down as soon as somebody pointed that out. But there are these logistical challenges. Now, we've done curbside projects with the city of Sacramento and a couple of other places, and there are instances where it does make sense. It's just not our preferred methodology because of the complications of, as the LA DOT often says, who owns the curb and what is the future of it? And when we are looking at EV fast charging in particular, we're looking at hopefully 10 plus year investments, and we can't always have that certainty on 10 plus years. You know, there are cities like Santa Monica that are moving to zero emissions delivery zones, but other cities are looking at what London has done and said, are we going to get rid of cars in a particular area altogether? Well, what does that mean for planning? What does that mean for logistics? What does it mean for where the power is? All of those are part and parcel of a plan for how you're going to modernize the cities as we move towards to full electrification.
Nice.
Excellent. So Jonathan, let's talk a little bit about expandability. When you look at, say, Tesla, which the supercharger network, I think most people should agree is kind of a model of how it really works. And one of the things Tesla did immediately was install many units at every location. I think they average 6 to 7 stalls per supercharger location. Now, Electrify America, another big player in the market, they average 4. When you guys started years ago, and it's not a knock, it's where the industry was, there was just no electric vehicles. You have more than 800 sites, but many of them are one station. Some of them are two. There aren't too many that I know of, at least, that are more than 2 or 3. I mean, at least in this Northeast area, you may be different in California or areas where have more electric vehicles. But where do you see the average stall amount on your new locations falling? And how about expandability of your current locations? Was that built into the contract negotiations that if you need an extra stall or two, you can drop in another charger or two? Or would it just be cost prohibitive because of the utility connections and stuff like that?
Yeah. So, Tom, a couple of things. One is, first, you have to take your hat off to Elon and Tesla for the work they've done, since not only have they put out so much charging, but they've dominated the early sales, right? And if you have that level of penetration of EVs, it changes the game, right? We talk a lot about at EVgo the need to have, you're skating just ahead of the puck. So you're building infrastructure that cars are using so that you can then build more infrastructure and have more cars and have this virtuous cycle of investment and innovation. And Tesla has been able to do that because they've been having the volume of sales is so strong. And that's where we all want to go, is building more and more. At the beginning, it didn't make sense to have very many chargers because you only had the occasional Leaf or i3 driver needing it as almost an insurance policy more than a regular use. We own and operate our chargers, and so we make money when the chargers are on and dispensing. That's what makes us so incented to have maximum uptime and that reliability. We're aligned with the customer there, but it also means that our first priority is making sure that it works, it's safe, it's reliable, and it pencils financially. Now, as penetration has increased, not just in California, but in places like Colorado, where we're now seeing 6 to 8% of monthly sales of vehicles being plug-in, sometimes hybrid, sometimes BEV, depending on what month you're looking at as far as the swing of that, we are installing larger footprint stations. So, you know, there's a new station, relatively new station by you in New Jersey, Tom, that's a 4 charging stall location. We have a new station that we've opened up in Santa Monica that's a 10 charging stall location. We have bigger and bigger footprints. I would say our default configuration now is 4, 6, or 8 charging stalls, but there are some cases where we're going much, much bigger as we look at where is the market evolving. To expandability, it ends up being a case-by-case situation. We often are oversizing the conduit so that we can make sure that there is an ability to upgrade. But as you move to higher power charging, you're almost always doing a utility upgrade. There are some cases where you don't have to do that and you have spare capacity, but the way that you work when you take service from the utility is you tell them what your projected demand is going to be. They build to that, and then you actually enter into, you have, depending on the utility, you typically have allowances. And if you don't have the level of throughput that you've projected, or at least a reasonable approximation thereof, the utility can charge you for that. And so how do you think about future-proofing? Mainly it depends on, do you have the ability to have the oversized conduit so that if you need to come back and do another project, you can, but you are going to have another project. It's not as simple necessarily as just plug and play, unless you have stubbed out make-readies, which we have in some places. You know, there's some of our projects in Virginia in particular where we've stubbed out some additional stalls, some in a few other states as well, but it will end up being a case-by-case phenomenon for expansion.
Thanks. And Dom, let me grab the next one because I see a comment I want to pull up. Mario asked this question. Mario Caballero, right. Why not offer Tesla connectors as well as CCS? Licensing costs Tesla requires? Now, this was going to be a question I was going to ask a little bit later on. Mario, get your head out of the clouds. EVgo is the only network that already offers Tesla vehicle charging. That it's the only network. So they actually do already offer a Tesla connector on their units. I don't know if it's all their units yet, but I will let Jonathan expand about that. And my question to Jonathan is going to be, how did you pull that one off? Because everybody wants to charge Tesla vehicles. I know that for a fact. ChargePoint, Electrify America, all the big guys, they would love to service Tesla vehicles, but without an adapter, they currently can't. How did you get to be the first and only network so far that can service Tesla vehicles?
Well, first, let's be nice to Mario. He's the one with the soft spot for EVgo, and we want to prioritize and encourage that amongst all your listeners. But you're right. We have currently 600 integrated Tesla connectors at EVgo chargers around the country, and we continuously look for ways to help serve that market. And if you think about it, given the penetration of Teslas in the U.S. and the fact that as much infrastructure as Tesla has built, there are a lot of places, including in Santa Monica, the backyard of EVgo, where there aren't enough Tesla chargers. And so those drivers are always looking for more options. And that's really what it's about, right? It's one of those things where we want everybody from the Tesla driver to the early IMEV driver to have options out there. And that means making sure that we're providing solutions that work. Tesla has been historically very reticent to work with other networks. Some of it has been concerned about safety and reliability and aesthetics and everything else. And the Tesla brand is so good that nobody wants to diminish that or take away from it. So honestly, I think a lot of it was just building trust, recognizing the great work that Tesla had done, having some very collaborative technical discussions and being upfront about, hey, our intent here is to make sure that we can provide an additional service and supply for the demand that's out there. And it's been a great collaboration in many ways to just say, hey, we want to do this. And it wasn't an overnight yes, and I can't speak for why none of the other networks have it, but it's been a great thing for EVgo because we do believe in electric for all, and that's something that we've believed for a very long time, and this helps us go to one more level of that mission statement.
Well, congratulations. That was a great cat to be the first and currently still the only network that has an integrated Tesla connector, and that is accomplished, by the way, if our followers don't realize, by there's actually a CHAdeMO adapter that's built inside the unit itself. So it uses the CHAdeMO side of the DC fast charging station to power the Tesla connector. Now, that probably means that you won't be discontinuing CHAdeMO at any time soon, which is some of our followers are always concerned about that. Some of the legacy Leaf owners, CHAdeMO is obviously going away in North America. Where everybody's moving towards CCS. Are you going to continue to support CHAdeMO on your new installations? Do you have a date in the future where you're going to sunset it? Like Electrify America has already decided outside of California, no more CHAdeMO in any of their new installations. What's EVgo's position on CHAdeMO?
Yeah, look, I think, as I just said a minute ago, we really believe strongly in electric for all. And it's hard to believe in electric for all and live that value if you're just going to completely isolate and strand a bunch of folks that are early movers. Especially when we look at it through the lens of the used EV market is so important. Most American drivers don't buy a new car. Forget new EVs. Most American drivers buy used cars. And so if we look at what's going to be happening over the coming years, especially if Congress does pass an incentive that has on the 30D tax credit, a used vehicle credit for the first time, that means you're going to have a lot of folks looking to buy used Bolts, used i3s, and used Leafs. And a lot of them will be in lower income segments, and we don't want to strand them. So I can't say that we'll always have CHAdeMO at every single station, but we are looking at it through this lens of, every station we build in collaboration with Nissan, which we have an agreement and a partnership with Nissan, as well as we do with GM, to continue to support acceleration of infrastructure deployment. Those absolutely and obviously have CHAdeMO on them, as the Leaf continues to be a very well-selling vehicle in a number of states. But additionally, we look at it through the lens of, where is it really important from a network basis? Where are we in proximity to what we call EJ screen communities? The EPA has an environmental justice screen tool where they take a look at disproportionately impacted communities, which are overwhelmingly communities of color. And they say, okay, these are the places that are most impacted by particulate matter emissions. And therefore, it's really important that they be able to decarbonize. And we prioritize those communities in our build out, and we look at proximity to those and proximity to other CHAdeMO chargers when we think about where we're deploying in our network to make sure that we are enabling everybody to go electric, not just folks that can't afford to buy Teslas or Taycans.
Right on. So can we talk about reliability just for a moment? So it's a huge issue for electric vehicle buyers. Tesla is perceived to have like near perfect reliability, while other networks have had issues. Obviously, it's easier for Tesla right now since they supply the vehicles, the charging equipment, and the software that controls the entire process. Well, networks have, may have to use charging equipment from a number of suppliers, and they have to work across a variety of platforms from different automakers that have slightly different software. So EVgo claims to have a 98%, I believe, uptime on its equipment. So we've had a few comments earlier in the script, in the chat, people mentioning some issues with chargers not being repaired fast enough or being down and maybe taking some time to get back up again. So what are the main issues that still arise for networks, and how is EVgo trying to resolve the issues it sees to create the experience that gives EV owners like total confidence?
Yeah. So a great series of questions embedded in those questions, Tom. I think I would start by saying, EVgo, we aren't a manufacturer of chargers, but we actually think that can be an advantage. We consider ourselves a technology specifier. And by working with multiple suppliers, we have the ability to say, hey, can you meet these specs? And if you can't, we can go to somebody else. And we have some element of redundancy in there of, hey, we can work with multiple, we can work with ABB, we can work with Signet, we can work with Delta. And that helps give us some leverage as well as some ability to manage supply chain and other things that go with it. But we have to be very blunt, and it's unfortunate, and I do apologize for the drivers that have specific issues with a specific charger. The fact of the matter is that COVID has made everything harder. And so in some cases, It's very easy to do a remote diagnostic. We have a 24/7 knock, and we are always monitoring the heartbeat of stations. And if we can do a remote start, if there's a software challenge, we're very on top of that, and that's very easy. We also roll trucks to go fix things. But if you can't get a part because of a supply chain disruption, it takes longer. And that's the honest truth, is that over the last 2 years, it's been harder to get some of the parts that we need. And so we've changed our inventory management to get ahead of this in the future, because it does feel a little bit like this is the new normal for a long while. But reliability is continuing to be the top priority for us. Again, as I said earlier, because we own and operate these chargers, we only make money when they're on and dispensing. So the customer is not the only one who's super disappointed when they get to the charger and it doesn't work. That's a missed revenue opportunity for us. So we are very focused on bringing all of them back online as quickly as possible. So where we have chargers where there are repeated problems, we look to replace the whole charger where that makes sense. Where there are chargers where it's about certain parts, we work very quickly to say, okay, can we find alternative pathways if we can't get that part? And it's also, it goes to Tom's question, right? What's the good reason to have more than two stalls? Yes, some of that is because we have more EVs, which is great, but some of it is also for redundancy. So that when you pull up to a 6 or an 8 charger stall site, if we have one site that's down and we can't replace the HMI because of supply chain disruption, there's 5 other options for you. Now, that's an ongoing work in progress and something that this industry is still working out, but it's something that we are very focused on at the moment.
Right. Awesome. Okay, so... So let's get into this separate issue. So a lot of automakers are adopting a frictionless charging system called Plug and Charge. EVgo began using a similar system, or maybe it's the same. You can tell us, back in 2019, I believe. You call it Auto Charge. So what vehicles are able to just roll up to an EVgo fast charger, plug in, and get the automatic charge initiation and seamless billing?
Yeah. So Dom, we launched AutoCharge back in 2019 with our fleet partners. And so we were doing that with especially fleets that were deploying Chevy Bolts, because the AutoCharge technology that we had rolled out relies on the MAC address, the MAC ID of the vehicle to be able to initiate that charging session. The whole industry is moving towards a broader plug-in charge ecosystem. I think every single automaker is prioritizing this on their roadmaps, as are all of the charging companies. But it ends up being a question of exactly how, exactly when, and how do we make sure that it's safe, reliable, and works for everybody. So, some of the automakers and networks out there have implemented a form of 15118 that was not the finalized standard. And now that things are moving to 15118.2, apologies for getting super nerdy. The question is, if that's not backwards compatible, Are there firmware updates needed? Are there other changes that are going to have to happen? And so we've been constantly working with automakers directly to make sure that we are in communication on what's the roadmap, how do we roll it out? Because we do know that that seamless experience that Tesla has is what every automaker aspires to. And so it's an ongoing discussion in the industry as we work towards rolling more technologies out. I think the fact of the matter is it will always continue to evolve. There are going to be ways to improve. And our CEO, Kathy Zoi, she often talks about the fact that we have to be able to try new experiments, stop doing the things that aren't working, and keep doing and scale the things that are working. And so we'll always be looking at the ways that we can do things better and better. We launched an innovation lab in El Segundo in part because we wanted to make sure that we had a place for any automaker who wants to come, and we don't charge them for that. And so if an automaker wants to come test a new standard or something else they're doing, we have all of the equipment that we have in the field, as well as chargers we haven't yet deployed in our lab, so that we make it possible to do more rigorous testing before cars come to market, as well as after if there are new innovations that are happening or other trends in the industry that need to be worked on. It's one of those things where UL is a phenomenal certifying agency and they do a great job, but they don't test everything. So there are some sub-standards or some sub-things that you would hope in this industry you would see more of. But the way that things are going in the future, you're going to constantly need to be working on drop tests and cold tests and immersion tests and some things that will continue to evolve. And the lab, our staff at the lab does all of that and then brings those lessons back to the whole industry as a whole, not just to benefit the EVgo network, but everybody in the industry.
So AutoCharge runs in a different way than plug and charge?
Basically. Yeah, AutoCharge detects the MAC ID of the vehicle and uses that to identify it, whereas Plug and Charge is using a different certificate. And one of the challenges, again, I don't know how in-depth we want to get on this, is who's the route certificate authority, and can one particular vehicle hold multiple certificates, and how does that work in terms of validation, prioritization, everything that goes with it? And there's been some challenges on that based on who owns which route certificate authority and which automakers want to make all that available. And it's still a work in progress, but there is great technical collaboration and we do see that being a pathway to be resolved in the near future.
So you're going to stick with this AutoCharge method of the MAC address way of doing it?
What I'm saying is I think A, watch this space. There's more to come soon. B, we're all working on a number of different options to see what's the best way to give the customer a great experience, because that's the most important thing.
Right.
There are some things that are called plug and charge that are plug and charge by definition on ISO standard. And there are some things that are called plug and charge that are plug and charge by another standard. The important thing for the customer is, does it work? Is it convenient? Is it reliable? Is it secure? And those are the most important things that we're all pushing forwards on.
So which customers can roll up to an EVgo station now and just get, what is auto charge, right?
Right now, it's just a limited subset of fleet customers, but stay tuned and watch the space.
Okay, right on. So, go ahead, Tom.
Sure. First, I want to make a quick comment. This isn't a question for Jonathan. This is specifically for News Coulomb, and Leonard. I just want to hold this up and show them it. And we're not going to really talk about it today, but they were referring to that in the comment section. Jonathan, installing DC fast chargers is extremely capital intense. And you have to deal with demand charges as far as operating go. You've got to deal with maintenance of the sites. Vandalism. We've seen instances where people like chop off the cables. And, I actually own and manage charging stations in New Jersey. One's a DC fast charger. It's a low powered one. So I understand what it costs to maintain charging stations. I've lost thousands of dollars over the years, but having this station doesn't make money. It loses money. What's the pathway to profitability? Do you have to have on-site energy storage to shave that demand curve off? Do you just need more utilization? I'm assuming most of your sites are not profitable at this point. What's the pathway to profitability with DC fast charging?
Yeah, look, obviously we take that very seriously, right? As I mentioned earlier, our commitment is to being sustainable financially and environmentally. And last year we went public. And so the continued pressure to make deliver value for our shareholders will continue to ratchet. But that's okay, because that's one of the things that EVgo brings to the table, is a very disciplined unit economics approach to deploying our charging stations. Now, to the very core question of demand charges, we've had this discussion a lot, and we piloted some very early battery storage systems to say, hey, is this an effective and efficient way of reducing demand charges and improving the overall economics of the site? And the truth of the matter is the most efficient way is to have rational tariffs that recognize the beneficial value of electrifying transportation. And we've seen that play out in a number of states, not just in California, where all three investor-owned utilities have either eliminated, reduced, or created demand charge holidays, but also you've seen New York and Massachusetts, where the legislature has directed the utilities to come up with alternatives to demand charge structures. You've seen it in places like Colorado, where there's a commercial EV rate. So those tariffs go a long way, because right now we have some places where our effective cost per kilowatt hour is north of a dollar. And obviously we're not going to be able to pass that on to the customer, but it means that those stations are not economic until we get relief on the tariff side of things. There are some other structures where it does make sense, where it's all about either the low volumetric or a higher volumetric for low or no demand charge, or because increased utilization can amortize that demand charge across the throughput and work out as a net positive. Overall, what EVgo looks at is what is the profitability of the station or the project on a portfolio basis over a longer duration of time, because we recognize that we are early in the game. Additionally, it's why we work very closely with automakers. I mentioned Nissan and GM earlier. We're working with GM to build more than 3,000 new fast charging stalls, that many of which would not pencil now. They would pencil later when we're at higher levels of EV penetration. But through the financial support from GM on that transaction, it makes those projects work. Similarly, public funding is a really key lever. Not just the federal funds that the Biden administration has put out through the infrastructure bill, but there was $250 million or so of light-duty vehicle charging infrastructure investment set aside through the states through the Volkswagen Dieselgate settlement. And a lot of those funds are still flowing right now. Some states haven't issued any awards yet, and that's still a work in progress. All of those are really important parts of the puzzle, but ultimately, the operations of a profitable network depend on investing in great technology, preventative and corrective maintenance, and a great networking solution to give a better customer experience so that more people will use your chargers. We think that's an equation that we've done quite well, but we want to continue doing well, because that's the way to profitability, is by having increased penetration. Really, we're positively exposed to increased EV adoption, which is one of the reasons that when we talk about policy, we don't only talk about charging infrastructure incentives, we talk about vehicle incentives as well. It does not make a whole lot of sense to build out 2040s infrastructure today before there's high penetration. We need to be building 2025's infrastructure today, but we need the incentives to help promote increased accelerated adoption of the vehicles so that we can continue to invest and have a sustainable build out of charging network that goes with the deployment of vehicles in the US.
So we know that stationary energy storage is being used to mitigate those demand charges, as you were just discussing. So you're not a fan of storage at charging sites to help with grid management and maybe bring in some more ancillary grid revenue?
So we think there are some limited applications where it makes sense, particularly in a fleet basis where you have a very predictable pathway. But if you think about it from the fast charging customer's perspective, when you get to that station, you don't want to have to worry about a storage event, a DER event, or anything else that's a revenue generation. It's on demand. You want what you need when you're there at a fast charging station. And additionally, the logistical reality of, we are working in somebody's parking lot. Sometimes we control the full parking lot. Oftentimes we don't, and we're in a retail situation. Taking another parking space or two to put storage out is not something that the site host partner, the permitting agency, the customer, they often don't all understand it. They look at it and they see another box and they say, why can't that box be another EV charger? Or am I giving up a parking space? And that's additional capital that has to be deployed. So there are some cases where it makes sense. As I said, we've tested it in a couple of different places, and we continue to look at for opportunities where storage will make sense. But there are also some programs where grid side makes more sense than anything else, right? The Sacramento Municipal Utility has tested a virtual energy storage shares program. We think about it from the same perspective on renewable deployment, right? We've put out a couple of solar canopies, but if you go to a simple example, putting 4x150 kilowatt chargers out, if you wanted to put photovoltaics on top of that to power it, you would need 47 times the footprint of the chargers and the ancillary equipment in order to have sufficient power. If you can do the generation and the storage on the grid side, that's a hell of a lot more efficient, and it helps make sure that you can build more charging as the industry continues to develop.
I think users do like the idea of canopies, and maybe they don't expect renewables to, you know, power that whole station right on site. But I think they would like to see some solar generation just to like offset maybe a small amount or for lighting or, you know, different things like that. But you've been working closely with GM for some time. I understand that they invest in you, and you, like as you were just saying, in turn you build out a number of charging stalls under that program. Recently, they increased the number of stalls to be built by 2025 through 2025 to 3,250. That's quite a bit of growth and expansion there. So this is a great way to finance some of your growth. How does GM benefit from this arrangement besides helping their customers find a place to charge?
I wouldn't say that's a besides at all. I mean, that's the core, right? If you look at GM and a bunch of other automakers that have committed to going 100% electric, GM recognizes that the only way to get there, and you know, they've been spending a lot of very real money retooling their assembly lines, is to make sure that customers have a convenient and reliable public charging experience. So that is the deal, right? They've agreed to work with us and help accelerate the deployment of more than 3,000 fast charging stalls. And in exchange, we're building them out, and we work together as far as collaborating on where they'll be and how to make sure that it makes sense in terms of the network deployment. And that's so that, you know, you and Tom can go out and buy a Cadillac Lyriq, or you can buy the new electric Hummer, or you can buy the new electric Silverado. And I think it's a very clear signal of, they want to make 100% EVs a reality, and they're doing that not just by deploying more and great vehicles, but also by helping invest in the infrastructure to really accelerate adoption of EVs across the country.
Right. So a little follow-up here. It was just announced that Toyota BZ4X buyers will get a free year of EVgo charging. Mm-hmm. I imagine that you have lines of communications open up to all the automakers, and this is under your purview, I understand. So can we expect similar arrangements from others soon? And also, will the BZ4X benefit from AutoCharge?
So a couple of great questions there. One is we're super excited about the new partnership with Toyota and the ability to make sure that as the new BZX4 comes to market, there's the ability to have charging taken care of. We think that's one of those things that is a great incentive for the customer. So if you go to a Toyota dealer, you know that Toyota has thought about where you're going to charge that BZ4X and the fact that they wanted to work with EVgo because of our reliability and because of the way that we can make sure to deliver great solutions for customers. So we think that's first and foremost. Automakers are all very different, right? Some automakers have decided they want to invest in infrastructure. Some have decided they want to invest in charging credits. Some have decided they don't want to invest in either of those, and they want to see what happens with the rest of the market. So we are having discussions with all sorts of different commercial partners out there, and we hope to continue to expand and build on those agreements. But really, we're really focused on executing on the deals that we have and continuing to show that that's the kind of partner we are. If you look at what we've done with General Motors, part of the reason we've been able to grow and have this partnership with them is because we started small. We worked on pilots in the early days. We've worked on the GM Maven Gig deployment program. And EVgo's mission is to make sure that we enable electric for all, and we do that by saying what we're going to do and then doing it really well and delivering for our customers. We hope that that's a model we can replicate with all sorts of automakers and fleets and other partners.
Great. I have a question. Site location. I've talked to some other infrastructure companies that said that when they're looking for site locations, one of their main focuses is lighting up a corridor. And, you know, they'll take point A, point B. Is that something that you consider, or are you just looking for individual locations that just would service customers? That's number one. And number two, as far as amenities at that location, is it required that there's a bathroom within, you know, 500 feet or a place to get coffee or something like that? Are those all baked into your site location? Maybe you could talk a little bit about how you guys identify new sites.
Sure. Yeah. Great question, Tom. So EVgo has developed our own internal proprietary siting tool that we call Amerigo. And that formula, it's a multivariate regression analysis that we've been refining over the years. And it brings a bunch of different factors into play. One is, I mentioned earlier, the EPA's environmental justice screen, and how do we make sure that we're prioritizing and serving disproportionately impacted communities and communities of color in particular. We've integrated the EJ screen tool into our siting tool. We've also integrated in amenities. What's the proximity to amenities? We've integrated in distance from competitor chargers. We've integrated in, you know, concentration of folks in multi-unit dwellings, BEV penetration, vehicle registrations generally. There's a bunch of different components that go into it. As we think about how are we making sure that we are deploying in a place that not only will that nth charger there get positive utilization, but how does it serve those communities? How are we making sure that we're increasing the value of our network to all of our customers? So it really is a combination of all those flavors that you mentioned, as well as other inputs. We look at it from a perspective of there are some stations that you build as connectors, right? If you look at our Baker, California station, that's where we have a great solar canopy, the first 350 kW in the US. It's connecting LA to Vegas because you can't get from LA to Vegas without stopping in Baker. So that was really, really important. But we also look at where do we need the next station in and around New York City, in and around Chicago, in and around Miami. And sometimes that will be just about population and serving the number of vehicles there and being projected. And sometimes it's how do I get from A to B? It's a complicated, not one size fits all answer. And that's because this isn't that easy. It is complicated. And we don't shy from that. We welcome that. And we work very collaboratively with our internal team and our external site host partners to be able to say, hey, here's where we want to go. Here's where we think it makes sense. Can we work together on that? It goes to the amenities question that you raised as well, Tom. You know, we've worked, if you think about the way that you want to integrate charging into your everyday life, especially in and around the urban core, being close to retail is a must. And sometimes that makes sense to be at a grocery store. You know, we've got customers and colleagues who they just plan a weekly charge around a weekly shop. So we've worked with Kroger and Whole Foods and Albertsons and all of those great partners because that's a great use case. So you, how long does it take you to charge? It takes you 2 minutes because you plug in and swipe and then you go do what you were going to do anyway. The same can be said if you were planning on going to get your haircut or going to drop off dry cleaning or whatever it is. So that retail proximity is very important and very valuable. But there will be other cases where it's, you know what, the most important thing is we need to fill a hole in the network, or we know there's a part of the city that isn't that well served. So we're going to go and get whatever we can there and we'll figure it out later. It's this combination of all sorts of factors, but that proximity to amenities is a very important priority for customers.
Okay, let me follow up with, since we're talking about sites, we talked earlier about some exciting vehicles coming to market, the Hummer EV, the Silverado, the F-150, Rivian, all those big pickup trucks. They may have different requirements in pulling into and plugging in, especially if they're carrying a trailer. Has EVgo made plans? Are there future sites in the planning that are going to be able to accommodate, say, pull-through charging?
Yeah, look, it's a really important question, Tom, and one that we are in dialogue with a number of those manufacturers about, because they want to make sure that if they have a customer, whether they're hauling a trailer or a boat or a jet ski or whatever it is, they want to make sure that they can charge. But obviously, the early days of this industry have been focused on retail parking lots, and it's super hard to get a trailer that's hauling something into a retail parking lot. I will say that just last week, I did see a particular automaker's truck clearly out testing with a bunch of things they were hauling in a retail parking lot. So I think they were doing exactly this testing. But I think it's a work in progress. And I think it's something that we and other networks are going to be continuing to look at, because everything is a trade-off. You want to make sure that you can serve those customers. But if you have the same amount of footprint and you could put more chargers, or you're paying rent on additional parking spaces, you have to look at the economics of it. So that is the push and pull of where are deployments going. We do know that this segment is extremely important, so it's something we're taking very seriously.
All right, so this one's might be especially suited to you. So what kind of role do you see for the government with regard to regulating charging networks? This is something other networks aren't necessarily happy about. They don't want the government making their job any harder, which makes sense. Is there anything you think government should regulate at all? Rates, equitable access? What is the role for government?
Sure. Well, look, if we think about the ecosystem of EV charging, there are a lot of different stakeholders, and that's often necessary, right? There's the charging networks, the automakers themselves, permitting agencies, utilities, site host partners. There's all sorts of funding agencies, all of those. When we look at the life cycle of deploying a charging station, the truth of the matter is on a fast charging site, we're often only on site constructing for 4 to 8 weeks. But the life cycle of deploying a charging station can be 12 to 18 months, sometimes even longer if there are delays with some of the utility side or with inspections or anything else like that. So one of the things that we did last year is, you know, Kathy Zoe, was at the Department of Energy when I was in 2009. One of the programs there was a program called Sunshot. And it was, how do we reduce solar below below the cost of a dollar per watt? And some of that was about the hard costs, but a lot of it was on the soft costs, permitting, standardizing contracts, so on and so forth. So last year, we decided to launch a program we call Connect the Watts to try and accelerate the overall ecosystem. You know, we talk about spinning the flywheel of charging. Government has a really important role to play there because permitting agencies often can be a major ally, and they can also be a long pole in the tent in terms of slowing things down. Similarly, funding agencies can be a phenomenal tool, but they may also slow things down. So how do we make sure there's a balance between getting the right incentive structures out there, having the right safety and other checks and requirements on there, but not slow things down? And I think that's going to be an ongoing work in progress. You've seen in California legislation that has been passed to say permitting agencies can't slow down the deployment of charging infrastructure unless it's for safety. And yet there are some local jurisdictions that aren't aware of that. And so the governor's office has been working to try and promote that. New Jersey, Tom's home state, has also done some really great recent work on accelerating permitting. And that has been a very important intervention from the state to say, hey, we know that if we're going to meet our EV adoption goals, we need to have charging. Well, if we start on a project today and it's going to take 12 to 24 months to build, that may not help us in 2022 and 2023. So what are the ways that the state can help accelerate that permitting process or work with companies on funding? You know, there's great programs. We mentioned a little bit about Appendix D from the Volkswagen Dieselgate funding, but also the funding coming from the federal government. There are best practices, and we've put out a number of best practices documents on the EVgo website, including on the Connect the Watts page. And when it comes to funding programs, that's in particular one that really matters, because you have different ways that sometimes you'll apply for funding and you might be ready to go to build a project, but the state funding rules may be that if you do any work, you can't get the funding. So, you know, Ohio recently came out with a revision to their regs to say, you know, you can build at risk. You apply for your funding, and if we award you that funding and you've built it, you're still eligible. But if you don't and you've built it, that's your risk. You have to wear that. And we think that's actually a really great best practice. Some other states have been very prescriptive and said, you have to wait, and we don't care if it takes us 12 months to contract with you. You have to wait. You can't start anything. And we're going to tell you exactly where you want to go. And that doesn't make sense, right? We've said, if you have priorities as a state on where you want charging to go, do a point system. And something can get more points if it's exactly there. But if it's, you know, one exit off the highway from where you wanted to be, that still serves a very important public purpose and shouldn't be DQ'd because of that.
Do you think the federal government could act in a situation like this to make an overall, you know, uniform set of rules for that sort of thing to get rid of that sort of roadblock?
So it's a good question. I think one of the things that we've seen, the federal government and the Biden administration has been really good in terms of soliciting stakeholder comment on this latest round of funding. And so there was an RFI, industry and nonprofits and others put in a bunch of comments. They have now put out the first set of guidelines for states to develop plans, but okay. The state plans still need to be reviewed. And there are more specific technical specs that the federal government will be putting out there. We have to see what comes out of that, but the federal government can be helpful in making sure that we are accelerating and working to streamline things. Again, what DOE did in 2009, 2010 with Sunshot wasn't to require things. It was to use convening authority and say, how can we make this better? And I think that's something that, you know, the new DOE-DOT joint office can do.
Right on. Okay, so, I've got a...
We've got a lot of questions. Dom and I are going to fight to get the last couple questions in before our hour is up, but I'm going to take this one.
Okay.
Jonathan, I have a question about pricing. I could be wrong, but from what I understood, and I should have checked this before the podcast, EVgo's pricing structure is 35 cents per minute. Is that how it works?
It varies by region. So
Okay.
Yeah, we're charging by kilowatt hour in California, and we've been piloting time of use pricing in California. Mm-hmm. And then we've got a number of different plans. If you charge, we want to make sure that everybody can use EVgo. And so for some folks, we do have customers that use us once a year. They just want the flexibility. They don't want a plan. They just want to be able to show up, use their app or RFID card or their credit card, and that's it. There are others that charge with us once a week, twice a week, every month, whatever it is. They may benefit from having a membership plan, or we've launched an EVgo Plus plan in some places to say, hey, we can get you an even better rate if you're a more frequent user. But it does vary by region, in part because our cost structures vary by region. You know, there are those markets that I mentioned where we're paying a lot more per kilowatt hour than we are in other markets. And we try and have cost and price, at least in some recognition of reality.
Yep. Does it, but how about the difference when you're charging by the minute? What difference when you plug into one of your legacy 50 kilowatt units versus a new 350 kilowatt unit? You're still charging the same per minute?
So right now we are. I think it's one of those things, Tom, that when we announced the switch on our pricing in California, we recognize that the industry is moving towards kilowatt hour pricing, and we are as well. But one of the things we said is we want to do it really thoughtfully. So we announced that we were doing it in California first, because that's where the bulk of the chargers and the bulk of the vehicles are. And so we've been learning some really important lessons over these past months, and we're going to be incorporating those lessons as we think about pricing on a go-forward basis.
Great. And I would personally urge you to move towards a per kilowatt hour. I think that's the most fair way of pricing. And there's something else I'd like to urge before I let Dominic have the last question, urge you to do. When you go on the EVgo site and you have the filters where you could filter and search for different level DC fast chargers, you have fast as 20 to 43 kilowatt, which, okay, it's a DC fast charger, but then listed as ultra fast is 43 and above. I think the general market doesn't recognize, does not call 50 kilowatt units ultra fast units. I think most people think of that as 100 kilowatt and over, 150 kilowatt and over. And we talked a little higher, bit earlier about education. Yeah, and higher. And one of the problems is I think we don't have a cohesive nomenclature for charging. And that was one thing that it personally bothered me when I went on the site and looked at it and saw ultra fast defined as 43 kilowatt and over. I almost think you should expand the fast from the 20 to say 90 and then say ultra fast 90 and above. But that's just my unsolicited advice.
You know, look, Tom, one of the things I like about every time you and I talk, you have suggestions. You come from the perspective of a longtime EV driver, but also somebody who's tapped into a broad audience. So I appreciate it. Can I ask you a clarifying question? Because I will take this back and talk about it with the team. Is it on the website, the app, or both? Just so that I can go check it out and see what we can do.
I'm pretty sure I was on your physical website on my desktop, and I was looking for chargers in my area and the charging speed. And I was searching for ones that were higher powered than the 50 kilowatt. You has the filter. I was trying to filter higher power units, and I saw ultra fast, and it said greater than 43 kilowatt. And I was like, oh.
Let me check.
That confuses people, especially newbies. It won't confuse most of the people commenting here and Dominic and I that understand power and how fast chargers are and ever. But somebody gets a brand new car and they go, oh, this is an ultra fast unit and it's a 50 kilowatt unit. I think that leads to confusion.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. So I think this might be an oversight. So let me check it out, and we can take this as an action item that you follow up with me on as need be.
I appreciate that.
All right. So we just got a couple minutes left. Let me wrap a couple questions into one thing here. So there are a number of charging networks in the U.S. now, with more on the way. What do you expect EVgo's market position to be in the future? Do you expect to expand naturally, or do you see consolidation as an element of future growth? And also, do you have any international markets in mind in the future?
So you're basically asking me to take out a crystal ball, and mine is a little bit foggy. But what I would say, Dom, is that, look, our plan is growth, right? We've been very public about our intentions to expand our network, both on the public side and the work we do with fleets. And we think that's really important. What's going to be really interesting is to see, is it everybody's interested in fast charging now? But the question is, are they ready for the realities? I think Tom's experience as the owner of a fast charger in New Jersey is very illustrative, because what we hear from some site hosts is, hey, we bought a charger from somebody, we had no idea what the electricity costs were going to be, and now we don't want to own it anymore. And so the question is, with all the new market entrants that are likely to come, either because of federal funding or because of increased adoption, how many persist? And there are obviously big players that want to get into this, some who already have, some that are looking to. There are little players. So the question is, you know, what is going to be the reality of this evolution? I think it's going to be an interesting couple of years, because, you know, Tom talked a little bit about EVgo being first. Guess what? Being a first mover means being a first learner. And there have been a lot of lessons learned over the past decade plus. There are going to be even more lessons learned over the coming decade, many of which will be very great for us, not so great for others, and vice versa. And I think that's a really key question, is what happens to the market entrants that underestimated demand charges, that underestimated the cost of maintenance. You know, we hear that all the time, complaints from customers that, hey, a new charging network cropped up and they're really excited about it because it's, you know, it's free or it's cheap. And then they find out it's not being maintained. It's like, well, that's a really important lesson to learn. What will be the evolution of those businesses over the coming months and years?
All right. Well, I think that brings us to the end of today's bonus episode. I'd like to thank you, Jonathan, for joining us and spending this time. I know you're a busy guy and have lots to do. There's a whole world to change out there. If you have any comments or questions, you can leave them on the Inside EVs forum podcast thread or on our YouTube or Twitch comment sections. If you like the show, please give us a thumbs up if you're watching us on YouTube. Don't forget you can find and follow our panelists on Twitter. You can follow Tom Logney at Tomalog. That's with two M's. And I'm at Dominic_Y. Click subscribe and tap that bell icon for notifications. And we'll see you all again this Friday. Ciao.